Welcome, everyone, to episode 58 of Underserved, featuring John Arsenal, CIO of Goulston Stores. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
John, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Good to be here.
So tell us a bit about way back in the day. I think you avoided having to be on a computer until like your senior year of high school.
Yeah, exactly. So I never had a computer growing up. I was entirely focused on athletics as a child and had no interest in technology really at all. I had a whole bunch of friends that were today called gamers. Back in the Atari Nintendo days, had no interest in that. Took one computer class in high school, but my lab partner was really into the stuff. So he would just basically take his assignments and make copies on an old 5 1/4 floppy disk, which I didn't even know that's what they were called back then. And he would change his name to mine and he would do all my homeworks. I aced computer class without ever touching the keyboard.
Well, that's a good friend. So towards the end of high school, you end up getting involved with Wellington Management?
Yeah, so my senior year, after football season ended, I decided to forego athletics and get a job after school, primarily because at the time my dad was sick. He had cancer and it was terminal, and I needed to get basically some money to help out my family. So in just sort of a random turn of events, my guidance counselor in high school helped me out getting an after-school job. It ended up being at Wellington Management, which was a wealth advisory firm. They were much smaller back then than they are today, about 250 people. And they hired me to come in for 4 hours a day and just do office-related work, schlepping around boxes of paper and changing out Poland Springs water bottle dispensers. And they grossly overestimated how much time this stuff took. So I'd be done with a day's work in about an hour and just constantly was bugging my boss for stuff to do. And he at the time oversaw office services and IT, which was fairly common back then. So he asked me about 2 weeks into this gig, would you like to learn how to fix PCs? And I said, sure, because my only real focus at the time was getting my $5 an hour. I didn't even know what a PC was, to be honest. And I was just sort of willing to do whatever he wanted. So he linked me up with this PC tech at the company, and he started to teach me all these different things. I sort of took to it pretty quickly, really had no intention of this turning into anything more than an after-school job. But within about a month of doing it, sort of the light bulb went on that this might be something that I should stick with. My original plan was to forego track season and play baseball in the spring. I never ended up playing baseball, and you know, 34 years later, I'm still in the industry.
Wow. So you're at Wellington, and I think I remember a fateful turn of events where your boss ends up leaving and you end up having to be the guy.
Yeah, exactly. About 3 months into the job, he decided to relocate to Atlanta. And back in 1988, unlike today, you couldn't just go find a PC tech. There weren't very many of them. And so we had about 200, 250 PCs networked on a Novell network. And there was nobody to take care of this stuff with him leaving. And so I'd come in after school at about 1 p.m. and I'd have this endless list of calls from people that needed help. And I couldn't keep up with it. So I stopped going to school for the most part and started going in full time. And it just sort of took on a life of its own. So I was the only PC tech. I was 17 years old. I looked like I was 12. I'd show up to people's desks and they would think like somebody brought their kid to work. And I was running around and, you know, baptism by fire. So you learn, sometimes the best way to learn is to just be thrown into it. And so that's what happened. You know, eventually they hired some other folks, but after I graduated high school, I went on full time with them and ended up spending a couple of years there.
Now you tried out college for a little bit, but said, I don't think this is my gig.
Yeah, I went to Northeastern for 3 weeks, and Wellington made a deal with me that I could switch to working nights, watching the HP 3000 mainframe in their computer room while I went to school during the day. And I was never a big proponent of school to begin with, going all the way back to first grade. It just wasn't for me. And so for the first time in my life, I had the ability to choose to no longer go. And I also had this job that I enjoyed much more during the day working with folks, and I was learning a lot more. And when I switched to second shift, the learning pretty much ceased. So 3 weeks in, I made the decision to reverse that. Kind of told myself maybe I'd do night school, but that never ended up materializing.
So you go on, you get some experience, and I imagine you start becoming in demand, and that's how a recruiter calls you about a new gig at CSC?
A recruiter called me out of the blue. I had never talked to a recruiter before. I didn't know what that meant. This person said they had a job at an exciting management consulting company in Cambridge. So I went and talked to them and really liked the folks, and it gave me an opportunity to work on some new tech. So CSC was coming out of firm-wide VAX setup and wanted to move to a Macintosh Novell setup. And so I thought, you know, this would be a new challenge, and ended up moving over there. You know, at 19 years old, you don't really have much perspective on what it means to change jobs and all that comes with that. So I was just sort of excited to be wanted, if you will, and have somebody call me and say this place would be interested in talking to you. And so I went with that. It ended up being a fantastic experience. Some really amazing people worked at this place, and the technology itself was fine, but it was really the exposure to the consultants that had built that business and some of the folks they worked with externally that was really worth my time.
So you learn a lot there. Does another recruiter contact you, or do you find your next gig on your own?
I found my next gig on my own. I did come through a recruiter, but somebody that I had met and got to know a little bit. And the reason why I decided to pursue something else strictly was pay. I had no idea what I was doing when I was at Wellington, nor did I have any idea how to negotiate compensation when Index called. But after being in the industry for about 5 years and talking to some people, I started to get a little bit of a clue that I was dramatically underpaid. And so TA Associates was a venture capital company back when most people had no idea what a venture capital company was. They actually were one of the first in the country, started in the late 60s. And at the time, they were still being run by the guy that had founded the company. About 50 people, so small shop, and gave me an opportunity to kind of run my own IT shop, if you will, a shop of one, me. So I got to do it all, and it was a pretty exciting opportunity because they needed everything kind of rebuilt, that the technology was very aged there. And I got to learn a lot about, in a short window of time, I got to learn a lot about the VC business, which would pay dividends down the road for me. I didn't realize that at the time.
So you learn about venture capital, you become interested in startups, and you go to what at the time is still considered a startup, MathWorks?
Yeah, I went to MathWorks. So my exposure at TA taught me that there were really two streams of technology people in the world. There were folks that did technology for non-technology businesses, right? They were viewed mostly as a necessary expense, and it was an operational role. And then there were folks that worked in technology and technology businesses where they were essentially the business. And this idea that you could go somewhere and get equity in the business and potentially grow your worth and value, not only from a skills and direct comp standpoint, but to have actually ownership in a business, was a whole new concept to me. And I sort of understood it, but I didn't understand any of the nuances of it. So I thought if you just went to an exciting technology company and you were valuable there, that you would end up with an equity position. And I had actually run into somebody that I worked with at Wellington that had done that after we both left there. And it's funny, I ran into him and he was driving a Maserati. And I couldn't wrap my head around, you know, I generally knew like what that guy was getting paid, and it wasn't too far off from what I was getting paid. I'm like, how in the world are you driving a Maserati? And his answer to that was stock options. And so he had gone to this company that it was a software company, had gotten acquired, he'd made some money. And so I started looking into this, and being at TA, it was pretty easy to learn that stuff because everybody around me was doing that. On the other side of it, I was a VC. And so I knew somebody that was selling computers into MathWorks, and they linked me up with somebody there, and we got talking, and I ended up getting hired there. Well, I had no idea, and this is kind of funny and pathetic at the same time when I look back on it, but I had no idea that you were supposed to negotiate equity as part of your compensation deal. I just kind of assumed like you showed up at these places and they gave you stock options. Well, MathWorks, you know, at the time was about 200 people. Today it's, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 people. And they've never given anyone in. They're a privately held business. They have never had any intention of distributing equity or going down the path of raising money from VCs or an IPO. That was not what they had in mind. And I didn't realize that until I was already there, which is, like I said, both funny and pathetic. But at the time, you know, I'm 24 years old when I landed there, so I'm still pretty young. And it turned out MathWorks was probably the funnest place I've ever worked, just from a pure fun standpoint. And so despite the fact that I was horribly disappointed that I wasn't going to get an equity position there, I stayed there for 3 years anyway, because that's how fun it was. Just such an enjoyable place. And the technology was absolutely phenomenal. You talk about cutting edge. We were the 74th registered .com in the world. For those in the sort of networking arena that will understand this, you know, we're a 200-person company and we had a Class B IP address scheme. For those of you that don't know what that means, it's unheard of. Those are reserved for the AT&Ts and ISPs of the world. So we're just really early on everything there and just so cutting edge and super exciting. The people that ran the organization really care about their employees, and most folks that go there stay there for a long, long time.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
I'm amazed you were only there 3 years. Like previous Underserved guests, Nausheen Milana, I think, was there for 15. Guy I went to high school with is still there. That's way more than 15 years.
Yeah, no doubt. I'll tell you, it was a hard place to leave. I remember being pretty torn about leaving there and being pretty sad on my last day that I was saying bye to the place. But I was very focused at the time on creating value for myself and my career. And I had set out when I went there to get into a startup that I could help grow and would in turn give me an equity position. So I decided it was time to go to the next gig. And this time around, I kind of knew what I was doing. I had talked to enough people that had worked at startups, and I had talked to enough recruiters that had helped people land at startups, that I had a real good sense this time around of how to go about it.
And so negotiate yourself some equity on your way into Navisite.
Yeah, Navisite just sort of appeared out of nowhere. They were a 40-person company at the time. They built data centers. When I joined them, they had one with a second one about to come online. So they're headquartered out of Andover, Mass., and they had built a small data center in Silicon Valley in a town called Scotts Valley, which is right outside of Santa Cruz. And they were looking for someone to run network operations for them across both coasts, which was like a 24/7 operation. And so essentially, Navisite was kind of like the cloud before anyone thought of cloud services. We called it managed services. And what we would do is we'd build these data centers. And unlike our competitors that would just be co-location facilities, we would do everything for the client up to their application code. So we'd acquire all of the physical hardware. We'd set up all the networking, set up the servers. We'd manage the operating system. We'd monitor and manage the sites. We'd work with the application team for the clients when they had either events or issues with their sites. It was extremely fast moving at the time. We were in the dot-com boom, and we were an operating company under CMGI, which a lot of people sort of have forgotten about today, but CMGI was sort of the ultimate internet incubator back in the dot-com era. And for about 6 years, they were the number one performing public stock in the world. They had about 75 companies that they had invested in and 10 or so that they had started from scratch. And we were one of the ones that started from scratch. So right out of the gate, the expectation the day I stepped foot in the place was we were going to IPO. It was just a matter of when. And so we grew like gangbusters. You know, we went from 40 to 600 people in about 3 years. Revenues just kept climbing, and we ended up building 3 more data centers, very sizable data centers at the time, again, in Andover and in Silicon Valley. And then we eventually had one in Europe. We had our IPO in 1999, and it was quite a rocket ship. Went out at, I think our original pricing was $14 and finished the day at $35. And within a couple months, we're at $100. And by March of 2000, we were trading at $330 a share, which was insane. And then by April, we were down to $75. And within 6 months, the stock was at $5. And so we went through the entire roller coaster ride of the dot-com era. And the biggest issue for us was the majority of our clients that wanted our services were also dot-com companies. So it wasn't that our business model was a problem. It was that our clients' business models were all really bad. And as they went out of business and the data centers started to empty, it became apparent that our perceived public value was going to really take a hit. The really interesting thing is that Navisite is still around, and the data centers that we built and managed are still there. They've gone through a few acquisitions where the companies that acquired them liked the name Navisite so much, they actually rebranded, the acquiring company rebranded themselves as Navisite. They're doing pretty well these days. So it's kind of cool to see that 20 something years later, they're still around.
So you ride the dot-com wave all the way into the beach, rip the skegs off the surfboard. What do you do afterwards in like 2001 timeframe?
Yeah, so I did pretty well on the IPO, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of take a step back and decide what I wanted to do. And one of the things about startups is they just consume your entire life, especially if they're successful the way Navisite was. And so for 4 years and even the 3 years at MathWorks, all I essentially did was work. I didn't pay much attention to my personal life, and that was fine in my 20s. But now I was in my early 30s and started thinking about things like, gee, I should take care of my health and should probably have a more balanced life. And so I got a call from somebody that was looking for a person to come in and rebuild the infrastructure at Harvard Business School. And it just completely different world, like so much slower pace. And it was appealing in the sense of I could do some cool stuff for this place. They obviously had endless resources. The world was going through the post-dot-com, post-9/11 financial crisis. And it was almost like a mirage in the desert, to be honest. It's, you know, thinking about, are companies going to get funded and are they going to be able to survive? And, you know, the stock market was obviously not very healthy and people were very fearful about what had happened on 9/11 and what that meant. And then here comes this place with this ridiculous 40 building campus, and they want me to come in and we've got whatever money you need. We want you to build a data center. We want you to backhoe the entire campus and relay the entire network and build everything from the ground up. And so it just seemed like a great opportunity to kind of have some work-life balance and do cool stuff for a place that had the funding at the time. I was able to bring some of the folks that worked for me at Navisite with me. And so we went there and we did all that for about 5 years. And then I got the startup bug again.
So you get the itch, and who calls you this time?
What basically happened was the first 4 years that I worked at HBS, we just had so much to do. We were literally digging up the campus and building data centers and rebuilding all the tech. And it was really exciting and really fun. And we were making a pretty apparent impact on the ability of the professors and the students to use modern tech. And that was really cool. But we kind of ran out of stuff to do, to be honest. And you go through those peaks and valleys when you rebuild stuff. My last year at HBS, I was fairly bored. And I thought, it's time to do something different. This has been great. I probably stayed there 1 year too long. And my original plan was to take some time off. So I put in my notice. I think I gave them like 3 months notice that I was going to leave. And my last week, I got a call from somebody that was looking to hire somebody at a company called CSN Stores, which I had never heard of. And they told me they're located in the Pru. They have like 230 web stores. You know, they do all this they were doing e-commerce with a really interesting slant, which is they would focus on a particular product set and they'd build an entire website branded around the product set. So nobody had ever heard of CSN stores. They heard of racksandstands.com and you name it.com, right? They had all these different storefronts, but didn't brand the company itself. So I interviewed with these guys, and the two founders are just really, really super nice people and very, very smart. And they had this vision of growing with the amount of e-commerce that they thought would eventually come into the marketplace, you know, being 100x over what it was at the time. And so they were pretty confident that even if they weren't incredibly profitable, or even if they went through some peaks and valleys in growth, that in the long term, this would play out real well. So I decided that I would join this group. And this was towards the end of 2007. And they had all these plans to scale the business, which was super exciting. And I had this team that I was going to grow. And of course, 2007 is when the financial crisis started. So literally, I walk into this place, which is almost as cutting edge as MathWorks was. Very exciting. Lots of young folks. You know, the average age there was probably 23. And we were going to do all these things. And then all of a sudden, you know, the bottom just dropped out of the economy. And we're in this crisis. And everything we were going to do was kind of put on hold. So expansion kind of stopped. And we were just sort of maintaining. But it gave us an opportunity to refactor some things and put some things in place in regards to preparing for scale down the road. And it was a great group of folks. I was blown away at how many really brilliant young folks they had hired, almost to the person. Like, it was amazing that they had done that in a very short window of time. And eventually they rebranded themselves. This was after I had left, but they rebranded themselves as Wayfair. And of course, everyone knows Wayfair now. And now they're thousands of employees. And the two founders, I believe, are billionaires. So their vision was right.
Thank you so much for joining this Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? Can you see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute. Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
Yeah, they took off like gangbusters, and then... during our latest crisis, the pandemic, everyone was ordering everything from them, along with all the other e-com vendors.
Right, yeah. I didn't end up staying there very long. And I think the timing of me arriving there, really, it couldn't have been worse. I was so excited to do stuff. And then we just weren't doing much of what we had talked about at all. And I was getting antsy because I had just come out of that last year at HBS. I was, you know, looking to do more stuff. And then I got to this place and I wasn't doing what I expected. And so I ended up leaving there and just took a little bit of time off to sort of figure out my next move.
So do you consult for a while before you land somewhere?
No, I actually was just kind of hanging out, doing my own thing and trying to decide, given that we were in the financial crisis, I was trying to decide how realistic it was to latch on to another startup. And there was a part of me that wanted to go do that and figured, you know, at some point it will turn around. I just didn't know when. And if you were listening to the news back then, it was like the sky was falling and the markets were in the tank and no one was getting funded. It was worse than the dot-com crash. It was worse than even post 9/11. And so I got an email out of the blue from a recruiter saying there's this law firm in Boston that's looking. It was a smaller version of the story that HBS had, right? There's this law firm in Boston. They've spent all this money and effort on building applications, and they've essentially ignored their infrastructure for the last 5 or 6 years. And they're putting together this team to address that. They want somebody to come in and manage the infrastructure. And at the time I was moving back to the city, I had lived in the suburbs for a long time. And I remember thinking, WilmerHale, I had never done anything in the legal industry. I had never heard of WilmerHale. What is that? Oh, it's a law firm. They're at 60 State Street. 60 State Street turns out was like a 15-minute walk from the place I was moving to. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll talk to them. And so I end up meeting the IT team and just an absolutely fabulous group, and ended up joining them. And we rebuilt a whole bunch of stuff over the next couple of years. I knew I wasn't going to be a long-term WilmerHale employee. I knew it would be a couple of years, get some stuff done. And when we're done and the world has kind of healed itself and funding is happening again, I'll go back to a startup. But enjoyed my time there and got to do some cool stuff for the firm.
Yeah, I remember 2009 like it was yesterday, like March of 2009. You're watching the news every night and they're like, the stock market lost 5% again. And you're like, we're like 19 days from being at zero. You know, it's just everywhere, everything going down. We were super fortunate at the time to have some clients that happened to be expanding, but we got to avoid some of that painful contraction of Navisite, but yeah, it was scary. So when does it start looking better for you?
My last year at WilmerHale, I had talked to a few startups. And so that was like 2011, 2012, it started to seem like, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Having been through, you know, what I had been through in the past, I knew it was really important to be picky. Like it's very easy to join a startup because it looks cool and it sounds cool and the idea is neat. That doesn't make for a successful business, right? Everybody has a great idea. Almost nobody can actually bring it to market. And I wanted to be part of something that could be successful because I knew I was going to thrust myself into another 60, 70 hour a week kind of job. If I'm going to do that, I want to hedge my bets and have the best chance of success. So after looking around for a little bit, I ended up talking to the folks at DataZoo. The guy that was running operations there recruited me in, and DataZoo at the time. So DataZoo was an ad tech platform, and it was born out of a person who had spent time at MIT working with NASA on developing big data analysis application to try to simulate space flight to Mars. And long story short, when the Obama administration took over and, you know, budgets change as they always do, the program got cut and this guy really didn't know what to do with his software. And someone introduced him to a person that had done ad tech before. And so long story short, they built this ad tech platform on that technology. And I would estimate that they had about a 3 to 4 year head start over almost anyone in the industry. And so DataZoo was small, it was about 50 people when I joined it, and they were looking for somebody to come in and professionalize the platform management side of the business. We were growing like crazy, and we went from 50 people to 300 in 18 months. It was quite a rocket ship, so to speak. I think Inc. magazine in 2013 ranked us the fifth fastest growing private company in the country.
Inc. 500.
Yeah, but it was, as I knew it would be, it was all encompassing. It took everything in me, right? I was working nights, weekends. It just takes over your life. And so in 2013, about a year and a half into DataZoo, my son was born. And for the first 6 months of his life, I didn't see much of him because I was working all the time. And that was starting to really eat at me as time went on. And I thought, you know what? I'm never going to get this time back. This is a life-altering event and I need to sort of reevaluate things. So I made the decision 6 months into his life to leave DataZoo. And I left with the purpose of taking some time off so that I could spend it with him. And, you know, I have a wife and just came home and told her, I'm going to leave this job and I'll split days with you. Every other day I'll take them and I'll do all this stuff. And I didn't know how long I would do that for. It ended up being 5 months, and honestly, it was the best decision I've ever made.
I liked your quote from the pre-call, no more startups if I want to be a good dad.
Yeah, so in those 5 months where I was hanging out with him, I had to figure out what's next, because I knew I would want to go to another startup because I loved that world. But I knew that if I did that, I'd be right back in the same situation. And that was the conclusion I came to. I can either be a really good dad or I can be really good at trying to grow a tech startup. And so I chose to be a good dad, or at least attempt to be one. And that led me to ultimately working at Goulston and Storrs, which is where I'm at today. So I went back to a law firm, which I would have never imagined I would have done. I had actually talked to Goulston when I was at WilmerHale towards the end there. They were interested in bringing me on board back then, but I wanted to do a startup. So I ended up choosing DataZoo. And ironically, when I was taking my time off, they reached out through a recruiter. They reached out to me again. And I just thought, these seem like really great people. It's a stable business. They definitely needed some help on the technology front, so I could contribute to the business and helping the company, but I'd also have a semblance of work-life balance. And so, long story short, I ended up joining them in 2014, and I'm their CIO now. I did know that having spent 3 years at a law firm, that the technology itself at the firm would not be a big enough draw for me. So I enjoy helping people and improving a business from an IT standpoint. But I've also had a very big helping of cutting edge tech over my career. And I very much enjoy that. And you just don't find that in the legal space. That's the reality of it. And so I wanted to find a way to sort of to keep my foot in the door in regards to cutting edge tech. And I ended up starting a side investment business, which at the time I started it was just simply out of interest of, could I actually do this successfully? And I knew it wouldn't take a ton of my time, which was important. And it's just kind of taken on a life of its own. So I've done that now for about 8 years and have done over 50 investments. And so I have the best of both worlds. I have a great place to work with really good coworkers and a great team in a stable environment that I enjoy working at very much. And then on the side, I sort of keep my nose in the startup world through this investment stuff. So I couldn't be happier right now.
You've had a pretty good track record there, right? Didn't you have a bunch of your portfolio companies IPO?
Again, this is against the backdrop of the greatest bull market in human history, right? But I've done about 50 investments and 11 of them have IPO'd. So it's been a great run. We'll see, you know, if I'm able to maintain that over the next 10 years. But so far, so good.
Now at Goulston Storrs, like, yeah, we've done some work with law firms and most of them tend to be pretty conservative. I know a lot of them resisted going to the cloud for a long time and were like, where's my data going to live? And no, I want it here in my little fiefdom on State Street. Or, you know, as far as innovating, they're like, well, what are the other law firms doing? What have you been able to bring to Goulston Storrs? Have you gotten them to use the cloud?
I'm very happy to report that we don't have a data center any longer. We actually shut our data center down a little earlier this year. We started right when I arrived. I sort of sold them on this idea that if we moved to the cloud, that you'd actually have better security. You would have far less maintenance work for your IT organization. So you could redeploy those resources into really helping the business. And so all the things that go into managing traditional IT, from patching and updates and upgrading applications and swapping out hardware and life cycling, all these things, all that stuff goes away. And you can then focus on the real value add, which is understanding what the different business units and practice areas are doing, how they're using their tools, what tools they don't have that they could use. And those are things that all law firms do to a certain extent, but they do have a tremendous amount of resources tied up in the day-to-day sort of maintenance of systems. And so they bought into that concept right out of the gate. And we talked about that when I interviewed. I think when I arrived, there was a little bit of a shell-shocked, oh, you mean we're going to do this right now? And you know, the legal industry is, as you mentioned, it's very incestuous. You know, everyone wants to know, well, what other firms are doing this? And so I sort of had to sell them on this idea of let's go out and find out what all the other law firms are doing, but let's not make that the thing that pushes our decision. Let's be informed and smart about what we're doing, but let's not be held back by other organizations' fear or just wanting to be ultra conservative. And so we started off with basic things like email and other SaaS-based services that were tried and true. But over time, we've moved everything to SaaS. At least any application that has a SaaS counterpart, we've gone there. There's a couple of things that help run the business that aren't SaaS enabled yet. So we have some VMs sitting in Azure running those. But I'm pretty happy to say we don't have any physical hardware whatsoever.
So that must have paid dividends right around March 13th of 2020?
Yeah, probably the best story for us around COVID. We were rebuilding, if you will, our conference rooms in all of our spaces. And we had had some old Polycom equipment, and we were swapping all that stuff out for Zoom. And the plan was to license Zoom for everybody in the firm after the conference rooms were completed. And so that was right in February-ish. And so when I started seeing the news of what was going on in Asia, and then people started talking about, well, it's going to come here. I remember the day I reached out to my director of support. He was the guy running the project with Zoom. I said, just go get the licenses for everyone right now. Get them today. He was like, really? Like, yeah, right now. And so we provisioned Zoom licenses, I think about a week before the whole world shut down. And the only reason we were able to get them so quickly was because we were already in the queue with that other project. They were obviously just being inundated from every company in the world. So our transition to working from home really only had one challenge, which was to get our secretarial staff laptops. They traditionally had desktops. And so we had to scrounge up some laptops and ship them to people's homes. But other than that, we were kind of good to go. All of our main systems were SaaS-based. People were able to access them from their home systems already. And then we had Zoom in place, and Zoom's pretty easy to use. You know, I tell people, if we had to do this 3 years prior, it would have been horrible. You know, the tech just came so far so quickly in regards to video communications. Obviously, nobody enjoyed COVID, but at least from the perspective of being able to keep businesses running, it was, I think, a huge success.
Yeah, you guys were pretty well prepared. You had already done your digital transformation, if you will, largely prior to that, and got lucky with having the big Zoom order already in the queue. Yeah, I agree. 3 years prior to that, like dealing with WebEx or something else that just wasn't, it was just too clunky. Installing the client, like everything around it was like, there was too much friction to make the thing work.
Totally agree. There's a guy by the name of Nicholas Carr, who was the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Business Review while I was working at HBS. And he wrote this article, Does IT Matter? ? And in the article, he questions whether or not an organization should invest time and energy in cutting-edge technology for the purpose of getting a competitive advantage. And his argument is essentially, if you get that competitive advantage, it will be so short-lived, it won't be worth all the trouble that you go through to be first. And so he ended up getting relieved of his duties for writing that article, because the dirty little secret at HBS is the majority of the faculty there make a ton of money off of consulting, not off of their teaching positions. And one of the major consulting streams at the time was around innovation. And so they didn't like that he had published this, right? And so he turns around and writes a book and changes the title from Does IT Matter? ? To IT Doesn't. And it's one of the best-selling business books of the 2000s. And so I am very familiar with him. And so on a trip down to the Bahamas, I saw that he had a new book. And I just picked it up at the airport for something to read on the flight. And his new book was called The Big Switch. And so I didn't know what it was about. I just grabbed it. I didn't end up reading it on the flight. I ended up reading it sitting on the beach in the Bahamas. And the book essentially details the parallel synchronicity between the electric industry at the turn of the century, so the Industrial Revolution, and the computing industry. And in this book, he basically argues that if you go back to 1900 and you look at a company's roster, every company has a vice president of electricity. And people hear that and they laugh, right? And they had an entire staff that would build these electric plants because at the time, there was no standard grid. And if you didn't build an electric plant, you couldn't run your tools. And most businesses were manufacturing businesses back then. And so all of these companies had these staffs that would essentially build the same thing in every business, just in a non-standard kind of way. Fast forward to today's day and age, and what do you have? You have a vice president of technology. And underneath them is a whole crew of people, and they put together all these sort of technical Legos that make your network and your server farm and your storage environment, and they have to take security, and they're all running the same software. They just piece it together differently, right? And so his argument was there was going to be a coming change that would be essentially the equivalent of what happened to electricity, where everybody would just plug into this grid and they would buy compute the way you buy power today. And that the application interface is essentially the same thing as the electric interface. So like if you buy a blender or a TV, you don't think about how it works. You just plug it into the holes in the wall. And there's a whole bunch of complexity behind that that you never have to deal with. His concept was people will eventually move to this model. And it was a precursor to the cloud, right? And he gave some examples in this book. One of the early examples was AWS when it was in its infancy. And so I'm reading this book on the beach thinking, within the first 40 pages, I'm 100% convinced that he's completely right because it just made sense. And I thought about everywhere I've ever been and everyone I ever know that worked in IT has this exact same setup. And it's usually a complete mess and very hard to manage. And it's incredibly insecure. It's easily hacked and people are just trying to keep up with it. And wouldn't it be better if you could just purchase this as a service? So that was my first thought. My second thought was I'm in a lot of trouble here because I've spent my entire career building infrastructure.
I am the vice president of electricity.
Right, exactly. And so I started to think, you know, well, I'm in my late 30s. I've got a long way to go here. What do I do? How do I hedge my bets? And I didn't know at first. You know, I wanted to land at a place that would allow me to play around with this stuff. And at WilmerHale, that was just not going to happen. It was a very conservative shop. And I talk about AWS and can we get some AWS accounts for some of our test lab stuff? And they let me play around with it to appease me, but they weren't going to let me do anything with it. And so I, over a little bit of time, became convinced that the best way to deal with this problem was to flip it around and evangelize it and actually help it happen. Right? You can actually move a business in a dramatically better way if you embrace the idea of the cloud and SaaS. And so when I landed at DataZoo, it was a huge opportunity to do that stuff. We were originally set up on all bare metal, you know, spread out on data centers all over the world. And we migrated the entire platform eventually to AWS and took advantage of all that. And it actually allowed the company to cut the cost basis of the product, which was a direct correlation to being able to be more competitive in that emerging industry. And that to me was the sort of use case that proved out this stuff's real. This is going to happen. And so by the time I landed at Goulston, I had to temper my excitement when I talked to people about it because I realized that most folks either didn't understand this or they were in IT. And they really didn't want this to happen. This was very scary for people. But it is amazing. I've heard, and I don't know how they come up with these stats, but I've heard like Gartner and Forrester and companies like that talk about the number of IT workloads across the globe that are still managed in a traditional data center. And it's over 90%, which is just mind-boggling.
Wow.
So you think about like all the companies, the non-tech companies in existence, the vast majority of them still have data centers and they're just dipping their toe into the sort of cloud space. They might have like Exchange 365 for email, but even that, I know a lot of organizations that still run Exchange on-prem. And so there's a tremendous amount of work that's still going to be done moving to this new model.
Huh. That's really counterintuitive. I heard a similar stat about online shopping a few years ago, that 90% of retail was still in person. And, you know, judging from the amount of Amazon boxes I see everywhere, it's very counterintuitive to me. And I think the pandemic maybe flipped it a few more points in the other direction. But yeah, I didn't know that people were still massively on-prem like that.
Like I said, I don't know how they come up with these numbers, but I think about that in relation to e-commerce too, because there's Amazon trucks in my neighborhood every minute of the day. But then you go to the mall and you can't find a parking spot. So I don't know.
It's someone. So John, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your stories and experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It was fun talking to you.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.